You are listening to WXRWLP Milwaukee 104.1 FM and RiverWestRadio.com globally. Past episodes of this program can be listened to at creamcitymedia.com/anti. I'm your host, NTSC, and welcome again to The Anti, a weekly primer on freedom. The Anti is anti-authoritarian, anti-capitalist, anti-hierarchy, anti-sexist, anti-racist, anti-fascist, and more. If we are against so much, what do we stand for? The ideals of freedom. In this series, we explore what a free society might look like while recognizing that none of us today are truly free. What would a free society look like? I ask that question, and the answer, as I learn more and as I read more and as I just sit back and think more, the answer to that question is a free society would look so different from our society today as to be almost unrecognizable. Arthur C. Clarke was quoted as saying, "Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic." I would like to think that along those same lines, that any sufficiently free society is indistinguishable from utopia. Anarchists always get called utopians. And it makes me, although I have arguments against that classification, it makes me ask, why on earth wouldn't you want to strive for utopia? Is your imagination so impoverished that you can no longer dream of a better life? Can you not fathom a world without poverty, war, disease, violence? Full disclosure, at time of recording, I am sick. I've finally succumbed to whatever plague is going around here after all my hubris and boasting that my immune system is so great and amazing. Here I am, sick and dreaming of utopia. There are a lot of things, a lot of concepts discussed and written about by anarchists and communists and socialists that seem inconceivable to neoliberals. And if you know, go back to the earlier episodes, by neoliberal I am referring to both Republicans and Democrats, the both of which are just two faces of the neoliberal project of our modern era. A lot of things are mysterious and confusing to neoliberals. Concepts like worker ownership of production, concepts like direct democracy as opposed to quote-unquote representative democracy, or industrial democracy, which is the combination of worker ownership and direct democracy. Neoliberals are confused by prison abolition. Now, all this isn't to say that some radical ideas have not been entering the mainstream discussion. But of course, those concepts are still wildly misunderstood and argued over by people who don't know what they're talking about, like the abolition of gender. Prison abolition, gender abolition, abolishing things. A lot of harmful, totally invented things is confusing to a lot of people, but they are tantamount to radical, progressive arguments. Today's episode is going to take on a Marxist concept of abolition that can sound on the surface very scary to a lot of people. I'm going to do my best to talk about this concept in a way that is accessible and helps to demystify it, explain it, and hopefully make it a little less scary. I think it's a concept that a lot of people think about maybe without even realizing it. Marx and Engels were in favor of the abolition of a lot of things. The one that sticks in most everyone's craw is the abolition of private property. Some people understand what that means and others don't, but it's at least a well-documented fact, and it's still on the lips of most leftists organizing today. However, something that ought to be abolished just as quickly as private property, but is overlooked more and more, is a dangerous, invented institution that stifles growth, endangers children, neglects the elderly, and perpetuates the very nature of class division. And that institution is the family. This week's episode is about the abolition of the family. That's a tough one for a lot of people to swallow, and I get it, you know? I love my family. I'm a lucky person to get along with and enjoy my family as much as I do. Just saying the phrase, abolish the family, probably gets a lot of people upset immediately, you know, before they even hear anything else or consider anything else. Because the institution of the nuclear family, as it's been come to be known, is so ingrained in our society. We don't know anything different from that. The case is not actually hard to make against the family. And when I say that, I'm going to have to say the nuclear family. That is what this week's episode is really against. But that's not exactly true. I don't know if I'll have time to get into the specifics of it, but the abolition of the family is key to the emancipation of the human family. It's key to dismantling capitalism and the patriarchy and class struggle as we know it. And I'm going to do my best using some historical traditional arguments against the family, and also just using some simple facts. And also appealing a little bit, maybe unfairly, to emotion. And you'd think, how the hell are you going to appeal to emotion to make an argument against the family? There's nothing more emotional than family. There's maybe nothing so fraught as the family. And, well, I'm not going to give away my entire argument too quickly. Just historically, within our contemporary memory here in America, the very concept of the nuclear family, the very concept of family traditions and family values has been used unequivocally time and again to attempt to undermine personal freedoms. Very simple examples, just going back a few decades. Traditional family values were used as an argument against interracial marriages, interracial relationships. So Southern lawmakers more often than not said that you would undermine the family if white people and black people could intermarry and have families. In our very recent contemporary history, which still continues today, the fight for same-sex marriage, for same-sex unions, for same-sex families. Traditional families have been brought up continuously in defense of one man, one woman marriages, stuff like that. Thankfully, the conclusion of those two fights have opened up the definition of the family. And in part, that's what the abolition of the family is to me. It's not so much dismantling the relationships between human beings, but it is changing those relationships. It is opening up those relationships. It is trying to deconstrict the ligatures that have been roped around the concept of the family. One of the other things that socialists and anarchists and communists want to abolish is borders. Well, those are, of course, geographic, physical borders, but they are also the social borders that we create around ourselves. And the family is a border. The family is an unnatural human invention, created societally along the same lines as property values. Sorry, not property values. I'm sick. You got to forgive me. Private property. Private property is just as much a border as any division between countries, as any division between states, as any division between counties. Let's go back to the not very recent, but the somewhat recent past. We're looking at the Georgian era, the Victorian era. We're talking about white people, white history, Europe. Europe and the United Kingdom. A man was the only person who could own property. Upon marriage, a man's wife was his property, and all the children she bore him were his property. Private property, not personal property. There is a distinction. But they were his private property. That is one of the historical tenets of the nuclear family. It's all about property. It's all about creating divisions. It's all about creating borders. This is my family, and it is not to be confused with your family. And this was such an important distinction that wars were fought and wars were stopped. Pieces were achieved by the combining of rich and powerful families. Family in this regard also points to the created, invented construct of lineage. Now, obviously, lineage is a thing. You can look back in your history and you can point to individuals and say, that person was my mother, that person was my father, that person was my great aunt, that blah, 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 blah. But looking inside the veins and the concept of bloodlines, this is another dangerous fascist, nationalist thing, a concept that is continuously brought up by some of the absolute worst people in history and in our contemporary era. Obviously, Hitler cared a great deal about bloodlines. Who still cares a great deal about bloodlines today? Neo-fascists, neo-Nazis. But historically, the bloodline pointed to whether or not you could, for example, belong to the ruling class. If you were not specifically of a royal lineage, if you were not of a royal bloodline, then you were not divined by God to control other people. You did not have the divine right of the monarchy, most of the time the divine right of kings. That is another construct of family that has been very detrimental and continues to this day. Look at any CEO of any Fortune 500 company. Nepotism is alive and well. Nepotism is just a fancy way of continuing monarchical power control that stays inside the family lines. Privately owned companies, of which there are, you know, stakeholders, but primarily a family lineage. Our own Marcus Corporation here in Wisconsin is a good example. Marcus founded the corporation, passed it on to his two sons, guarantee those two sons will pass it on to their children, et cetera, maintaining a familial line of extreme wealth that will not be available to anybody that is not in the family. And of course, you can marry into the family, but marriage, let's not ever forget, began as a contract between two families to secure the continuation and the aggregation of their wealth and power and their land more often than not. In this way, family perpetuates class divisions in our society. The rich stay rich because their family has historical wealth that is based entirely on their lineage. You can look back, you can look at the Rockefellers. You can look at descendants of the Habsburgs, who were the monarchy for almost every single kingdom in Europe around the time of World War One. These families have generational wealth that they got from the backs of slaves that perpetuates to this day. Whereas if you do not have generational wealth in our contemporary era, the odds of you getting real wealth, wealth that generates wealth, the odds of you getting that are very, very low if you do not already benefit from generational class wealth as dictated by your family history. Let's talk a little bit about some of the dangers of the family itself, not even taking into consideration the class element. So the data shows conclusively that most violence, most rape, most murder actually happens between people who know one another, and most often among family members. The guilt associated with the concept of family, of the family unit, the concept of blood ties, of lineage, all of that silences people who might otherwise speak out against their abusers. Let's talk about children and just how much the family endangers them. So any family, any nuclear family, is expected to have its own kind of way of doing things. Family traditions, right? Some of these are harmless. Some of these are very harmful. You can look to any LGBT youth growing up in a highly conservative family. Those family traditions are technically going to be very counterintuitive to the personality that this child is developing as they grow. And time and again, millions of youths are kicked out of houses, kicked out onto the streets, disowned by their families simply for the fact of being LGBTQ. This happens all over the world, not just in America. And it is that family structure, it is that family history that not only creates the environment that this child must grow up in that is dangerous to their emotional state, their mental state, but then when they are kicked out, because our society entrusts the family with all the responsibility of care for children, these people have nowhere to go. 43% of homeless youth just in America identify as being LGBTQ. Other examples of homeless youth who find themselves on the street instead of in a home of some kind are fleeing abuse. They're fleeing abuse by parents or siblings or grandparents in the case that there are multiple generational homes, which are becoming rarer and rarer, and we will get into that. So that is one form that family tradition takes that is dangerous to children. Another simple form of family tradition that is dangerous for children is it absolutely hinders the development of personality, or what Marx called the right of free development of the personality. Many, many families are completely authoritarian, and they create by their very nature, or they attempt to create, obedient, repressed humans who are afraid to step out of the societal norm as precedented by their parents. This can take many, many forms beyond just the typical, you know, hatred for LGBTQ youth. For example, if a son is not conforming to the expectations of his father, that creates trauma for the son. Same with daughters. If they are not conforming to what is considered to be virtuous or modest by the standards of their parents, that is traumatic for that daughter. Even in the case where the traditions of a family are not directly traumatic for the children that are being raised in that family, they are stifling nonetheless, in that children have, at least in this nuclear family, precious little exposure to other ideas, to other ways of living, other ways of being, other methods of communication. And again, the state vociferously protects the rights of the family to do essentially whatever the hell they want, so long as it's not physically abusive. And even then, in some circumstances, states allow that. So, for example, many years ago in 2009, I dated somebody whose mother almost certainly had borderline personality disorder, or at least, and obviously I'm not licensed in any regard, but having done the research that I did, it was some sort of narcissistic personality disorder. And I don't want to demonize this woman, because she obviously did what she could with the tools she was given. However, because our society takes 100% of the responsibility for the raising of children and puts it on whoever's available, more often than not, that's the mother, that is extremely stressful for everybody involved. Mothers in particular are expected to be flawless, perfect human beings with the most energy and patience and kindness and love, and they are expected to do all of that for free and with no gratitude whatsoever. And they are expected to produce perfectly productive members of society, even though for the most part, mothers are not given training. Mothers are not given anything except the experience they received from the raising of their own parents. That's all they have, and nothing more. And that's all any of us have, because we are trapped as we grow in the family structure, for good or for ill. And in many cases, definitely for ill. And I'll say again, I'm very, very lucky that I learned communication from my family, that I learned patience, for the most part, from my family. But not everybody gets that. And because children are trapped, they are truly trapped, unless they have an advocate, a legal advocate on their behalf, there is nothing they can do to escape a bad family situation. And most don't. Let's talk about the elderly. So we talked about multi-generational families. Well, what's happening because of our capitalist grind that most of us are forced to endure is our old people are not cared for in the same way that they would have been in an older time. And so much of this is just an unnecessary construct. Family used to mean so much more, and if we have time, we'll get to that. But our elderly are categorically being dismissed. They're being shunted away into expensive homes that take most of their Social Security, if they have Social Security, or it takes the funds of the family who are putting them there and closes the door. And for the most part, their children and grandchildren don't have the time to give to them, just for visits, for general kindness. And people make the effort, but don't you feel terrifically guilty any time that you forget about those old people in your life? Don't you feel guilty for not calling? Don't you feel scared or sad that someone who is not you is now responsible for their upkeep? But then don't you also feel a little bitter that you are expected, that expectation falls to you for their upkeep? As parents, don't you feel a little bitter sometimes that you are expected to take care of these human beings 100% on your own? And asking for help is always looked down on. Asking for help is nearly shunned by our society, because you're supposed to be perfectly knowledgeable, perfectly capable of raising these human beings to be also perfectly knowledgeable and perfectly capable. And it's a cycle of structural violence. In this system, and we've talked about this in past episodes, lack of birth control, lack of family planning options is intended very purposefully to imprison people in poverty, because any child that you have is your responsibility 100%. And if you do not meet the needs of that child up to the standards of the state will punish you by taking them away and putting you in prison, thereby damaging both of you. The state wants young mothers who are poor and cannot take care of their children, because it will keep them running in the rat race, and it will make sure that those children are equally impoverished and they can be more easily siphoned and funneled into the prison industrial complex. It didn't used to be this way. For most of human history, the concept of the family didn't really exist. The concept of the tribe, however, did exist, and it is one of the absolute oldest institutions in human society. And that, to me, is what the abolition of the family really means, is the abolition of this nuclear, enclosed, encapsulated, violent institution, opening it up to the human family. The human family, for me, which is the phrase I use all the time, means the global family, the communal community family, where children aren't raised by just the people who, you know, who created them genetically. Children are raised not just by even their aunts and uncles and grandparents, but they are raised by people to whom they are not actually genetically related. There are examples of this all throughout nature in eusocial and social animals alike, where all of the young are cared for by everyone, because in that way, parents all have a little bit more time. They all don't have to be as stressed. They all don't have to be as terrified that their young are in danger. And in the same way, the young of the world, the young of the human family, would get so much more exposure to ideas outside of the people that bore them. They would get so much exposure beyond their sisters and brothers and their cousins to the whole of the children in the community. And then likewise, the elderly would also have so much more support, because that onus would not fall only on their children and their grandchildren to take care of them into their old age. The onus of support falls on all of us when we extend the definition of the family and we do away with the totally arbitrary borders that the nuclear family creates. That, to me, is what the abolition of the family is really all about. And we can talk more about domestic violence, and we can talk more about neglect, and we can talk more about how we could communalize the family and how we could do a better job of sharing resources and sharing spaces and creating areas and spaces in which everyone can develop themselves with total freedom and agency. To do that, we've got to have very real conversations about what we expect of one another, what our obligations to each other are, and why we have ever allowed ourselves to think that those obligations end or begin because I'm technically related to you. It's ridiculous, and it's infantile, and it's dangerous. Thank you so much for tuning into The Anti here on WXRW LP Milwaukee. I'll be back again next week to talk further about concepts relating to our freedom and awesome shared potential. Past episodes are available at creamcitymedia.com/anti, and more information about the show can be found at riverwestradio.com. There's more stuff coming up next week. Hey, Sandy, what's going on in River West?